You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Knetter.
Mining company has the go-ahead to do some exploratory drilling for copper and gold in northern Wisconsin. We'll get two perspectives on the potential for a new mining operation here in the state.
Now, a bill that would legalize medical marijuana in Wisconsin got a hearing in the state legislature this week. Republican State Senator Mary Felskowski is the bill's sponsor.
Don't see that it's government's role to stand between me or you and a natural product with less side effects than some of the prescription drugs that we had.
The legislature's session is over, so the bill won't get a vote this year. And even though surveys show strong bipartisan support in the state for legalizing medical marijuana, it's not clear if enough state lawmakers feel the same.
We're talking about Wisconsin's approach to marijuana and how it compares to other states and what's happening at the federal level.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Would you like to see medical marijuana legalized at the state level? How about recreational marijuana? Should the federal government make those things legal? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Alex Kreit is an assistant professor of law and the director of the Center on Addiction Law and Policy at Northern Kentucky University. Alex, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
There has been a pretty big shift in marijuana in the U.S. on the state level during the last decade or so. How out of step or in step is Wisconsin with how other states are handling marijuana right now?
Wisconsin's pretty out of step at this point in not having a comprehensive medical cannabis law. 37 states have that already, and including a lot of much more conservative states. States that are much more conservative than Wisconsin, and you've got 18 states that have legalized all adult use recreational legalization. So Wisconsin's getting to be in a pretty distinct minority and not having a comprehensive medical cannabis law at this point.
Now, this latest bill here to legalize medicinal marijuana is authored by a Republican. That said, it's still considered a pretty heavy lift to get this through our Republican-controlled legislature. And it sounds like, from what you just said, Alex, there have been Republican majorities in other states that have gone ahead with some kind of legalization?
Yep. Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi, are all states where you've had legalization passed through the state legislature in Mississippi. I believe it was following a ballot measure that was struck down, but then went successfully through the legislature recently. So, yeah, you've had this passed with success in pretty conservative states through the state legislature, and of course, in states that have the ballot initiative process, that's a whole different circumstance because it can be put directly before the voters. But you've also had states with ballot measures that are conservative states, like Montana, where it's passed by ballot initiative. But even in states without the initiative process, there have been some pretty deeply conservative states where medical marijuana has passed through the state legislature.
We've also seen a fairly big shift in the public support for legalization. Here in Wisconsin, surveys have showed more than 60% of people support legalizing recreational pot, and a few years ago, a survey showed 83% supported medical marijuana. What do you think has driven that growth in public support for legal marijuana?
I think really probably the biggest thing is just people seeing how it's played out in the states that have legalized it recreationally. I mean, I think you've had for quite some time, really, a supermajority level support for medical marijuana. The polling for that has been really, in the 70s plus nationwide since the early to mid 2000s. So I think that for medical, that's had really this kind of level or close to this level of support for a while. And for recreational marijuana, I think that's something where people really have seen as, the legalization states, legalization has played out in the states that have legalized it. I think more and more people are looking at it and saying, the sky hasn't fallen. People who were maybe skeptical of it or who were opposed to it but not strongly so are looking at how it's playing out in those states and saying, hey, this isn't maybe as bad as I feared that it was going to be. There are some pluses to this, and I think that that's really swaying public opinion.
And in those states where we do see legalized medicinal marijuana, what kind of restrictions come with those laws? What is the process to obtain medical marijuana if it is legal?
Yeah, it varies, you know, state by state. Certainly there's a pretty big degree of variation as to how restrictive each state is. But generally, you know, of course, the big thing that every state's going to require for medical marijuana is going to be a doctor's recommendation. And it's a recommendation, not a prescription, because it's still illegal federally. And, you know, so it doesn't have the same, it's not sort of the same process that you would have for a prescription for an FDA-approved product. But, you know, a similar type of thing, going to see a doctor and getting a recommendation. A lot of states have restrictions, or some states, I should say, have restrictions on what it can be recommended for, and they might have a list of particular ailments and say that it can't be recommended for anything other than that. Some states are a little bit more open-ended and leave it to the doctor's judgment in that regard. So you've got sort of those kinds of rules and regulations and restrictions in terms of who can access it. And then, of course, there's the whole world of regulatory oversight of the manufacturing, the sales process, you know, rules about testing the product to make sure there's, you know, no impurities and all that sort of thing.
We're talking with Alex Kreit right now, assistant professor of law and an expert in cannabis law and policy at Northern Kentucky University, looking at how Wisconsin compares to the rest of the country when it comes to marijuana after a hearing on a bill to legalize medicinal pot in the state capitol yesterday. Alex, Wisconsin is bordered by Minnesota, Michigan, and Illinois, three states that have legalized marijuana to some extent. And I know you've looked at situations like this. When there is a state like Wisconsin that's a bit of an island, what effect do we see or not see from other states that have some version of legal pot?
You know, I don't think that there's a huge effect on use, but it certainly puts the states, you know, that don't have legal marijuana kind of in a circumstance where they're missing out on the potential for tax revenue. I think that the reason that there's probably not, an indication of a significant impact on use is that, you know, marijuana, even when it is illegal, is pretty accessible and available. I mean, and then frankly, is I think one of the things that, proponents of legalization cite to and that people look at and say this is, you know, a reason why maybe prohibition hasn't worked and it's time to consider legalization, is that even with, you know, prohibition, even with the war on marijuana, it's not that difficult for people to get marijuana in a state where it's completely prohibited. So certainly in, you know, states like Wisconsin where it's prohibited, there, you know, if for people who live close to the border to a legalization state, you know, somebody who lives close to Illinois, they might decide to drive across the border to Illinois and buy it there, you know, and perhaps, you know, people who maybe were buying it before from illegal dealers in Wisconsin might do that, or some people who, you know, might not otherwise use it might decide to drive across the border and get some for personal use. But I don't think there's been a significant impact in terms of sort of overall availability of marijuana in states where it's illegal, just because they're bordering states where it's now made legal. The reality is it's already very available, and it has been for, you know, pretty much the entirety of marijuana prohibition. So so I don't think that it's made it more available per se, but it has made it a little bit more convenient maybe for people who, you know, might want to drive across and get it from a regulated store across the border in Illinois.
Sure. I want to take a caller now at 800-642-1234. We have John in Sauk City with us. Hey, John.
Oh, hi. How are you doing?
Good. What was on your mind?
Oh, yeah. I was, I just kind of had to write this down so I can focus my thoughts here. But my idea was, I was wondering if there was, if your guest knew anything about licensing of cannabis. And, you know, particularly for, like, small farmers. And the concept is that I'd like to present is, how do we prevent, you know, big, you know, I hate to say big business, but how can we prevent big business from owning the licenses for growing cannabis?
Sure. John, thanks for the call. Oh, and I want to throw that to Alex. This is not an issue here in Wisconsin at this time, but other states, I'd imagine, have had to talk about things like who gets to farm cannabis, who gets to sell it and distribute it. How have they gone about answering those questions?
Yeah, I mean, I think you've seen a range of approaches, and a lot of it really depends on, to what extent the state wants to try to, kind of have it be as much of a kind of open-ended free market thing versus trying to encourage or have a market where small businesses can thrive. And that, I think, certainly is in small farms in the case of manufacturers. There, I think, are ways that you can try to structure the regulatory regime to do that, things like rules surrounding how many licenses any one entity or group can hold at one time, the size of the farm or the manufacturing operation for each licensee. So there's a range of sort of regulatory tools that states can and have used to try to address that issue. And certainly, I think in some states there has been that kind of effort to prevent the corporatization of the marketplace or the total corporatization or takeover of the marketplace. And again, it's a range of approaches. Some places, might have a regulatory structure that allows for those large-scale enterprises, but also has regulations and licenses in place that would try to encourage and facilitate, craft cannabis, if you will, sort of maybe similar to a craft beer maker versus the large conglomerates. So, we've really seen a range of approaches to that.
We're talking to Alex Kreit. He's an assistant professor of law and the director of the Center on Addiction Law and Policy at Northern Kentucky University. With us today to talk about an effort in Wisconsin to legalize medical marijuana and how Wisconsin's approach to marijuana compares to states around the country.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see marijuana legalized for medical use, for recreational use in Wisconsin? Are you in one of our neighboring states that has one of those laws in place? How are things working out in your community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org.
We'll continue the conversation and maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
Dean Knetter. We're talking about marijuana policy in Wisconsin and across the country. A bill to legalize medicinal use in Wisconsin got a hearing in the state legislature this week. Alex Kreit from Northern Kentucky University stays with us.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see a medical marijuana law pass here in Wisconsin? How about recreational marijuana? What questions, what thoughts do you have on the issue? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
We'll go back to our callers now. Martha is with us in Menominee. Hi, Martha.
Hey, great to hear this program. Yes, I would fully support this bill. I would like to borrow your microphone to speak to the Republicans in the state legislature on this because a few of them are quite uninformed. On this very show, I heard one Republican congressman on this subject last year spout a bunch of scientific misinformation and gobbledygook, called his office, asked them to send me the study he cited that, marijuana causes addiction and it is a gateway drug, which is all untrue, and couldn't get a call back, never heard anything. But it was on this show that I heard this first being debated last year. So I think the Republicans in the state need to be educated. They need to educate their fellow Republicans and get this done because two-thirds of the country want these laws passed. And these days, two-thirds of the people can't get together on anything, but they've gotten together on this.
Gotcha. Martha.
Yeah.
Thank you for the call, Martha. Alex, we mentioned earlier that public opinion is pretty strong in support of legalizing marijuana to some extent. But in Wisconsin and some other states, the politics haven't kept up with that. In those instances, are there misconceptions out there that you see a lot of that you think could use some correcting?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, maybe a big, part of it certainly is sort of the long memory maybe some politicians have for the anti-drug sort of drug war era. Certainly any politicians who kind of came of age politically in the 80s and 90s and even to a lesser extent, the early 2000s, They, you know, I think maybe are much more of the mindset of the war on drugs having, you know, strong, resolute political support. And even though the, you know, sort of lay of the land has shifted dramatically, I think there's a contingent of politicians who are kind of still maybe stuck in that mindset, or concerned that this is, you know, even if the polls say that people support it, that it's not as popular as the polls say for X or Y reason. And so I think there's that, you know, component of it, certainly. And I think that, you know, for medical cannabis, I think that there are, you know, something I've seen, you know, people say, well, unless and until the FDA approves this, you know, but the reality is that there has, you know, research into the medicinal uses of marijuana has been stifled for a long time because of the federal prohibition. There have been efforts to, you know, increase research, but that's sort of one of the reasons that states have led the way in enacting medical cannabis laws. And, you know, some of the medical uses, I think, are, you know, just kind of, I mean, common sense in a way. I mean, the chief one to help with nausea, I joke to my students when I teach my drug law class, you know, do how many studies do we really need to know that marijuana can make you hungry, right? I mean, for, you know, in a way, obviously, if you're just a recreational user, you know, smoking some marijuana and eating some more chips, it could be a funny thing. But of course, if you, you know, are undergoing chemotherapy, it's a real legitimate medical use to have something that can help stimulate appetite. And so I think there's kind of a misconception that, well, it's not FDA approved, and so states can't move on this issue. But, you know, of course, we have 37 states that have already done that, and that's helping to, I think, encourage the prospect of federal reform and more research that is federally authorized.
And just this month, a bill to decriminalize marijuana on the federal level did pass the U.S. House, a couple Republican votes, I believe, in support of it. That is still awaiting a vote in the Senate, where it would need 60 votes to pass. But Alex, can you give us a sense of what this federal bill would and wouldn't do?
Yeah, so the bill that passed in the House is the MORE Act, and there's a similar measure that's going to be introduced, it looks like right now in August, by Chuck Schumer and some other senators in the Senate. And so, you know, the MORE Act would legalize marijuana federally. It wouldn't supersede state law. So states that have prohibitions, those would remain in place at the state level. But of course, I think if federal law were to change, that might encourage some states that currently have prohibition and are on the fence to rethink it. But it would legalize marijuana federally. It would tax marijuana federally. It would start at a 5% tax under the MORE Act, that, you know, that which is the one that passed the House again. It would expunge nonviolent federal marijuana convictions and would have some incentives for states to expunge marijuana convictions at the state level. There would also be some provisions for social equity to try to help small businesses, to try to help people who might want to get in the marijuana business who've been negatively impacted by the war on drugs, that sort of thing. So it's a pretty comprehensive proposal. And even though, you know, like you, as you said, it got a couple of Republican votes, there's actually a competing in the House legalization proposal that is being has been put forward chiefly by Republicans. So even though the MORE Act itself only got a few Republican votes, that I think kind of undersells a little bit the amount of support for the idea of federal reform in the House among Republicans. There's a pretty significant contingent of Republicans who didn't vote for the MORE Act but support a competing measure. So I think there's really starting to be some real movement there at the federal level, but, you know, that the Senate is probably going to be the hardest lift because of the issue of the filibuster and the need to get, 60 votes there for something to pass.
Time for one more caller. We have Pam in Southwest Wisconsin. Hey, Pam.
Yeah, can you hear me?
I can. Go ahead. Yeah.
I had a quick question because I know CBD is not the same as marijuana at all, but we have some CBD stores here in Wisconsin, and I noticed they'll say, oh, you know, this is the legal kind, it's Delta 8 and Delta 10, not Delta 9 or whatever, but they have THC signs. And when you read the ingredients, it says THC. And so I'm just sort of curious, like, how they can get by, which is great because it's a helpful product. But how is it they're able to get through without, is it because even if they have some component of THC?
Sure. Pam, thanks for the question. Alex, how are we drawing the line between when it comes to THC content?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's something that's where there's actually, I think, a fair amount of uncertainty currently in the law on a component of it. So under state law, Wisconsin does have a CBD-only law. There's only three states that have no medical cannabis law whatsoever. So Wisconsin's in the group of, I think it's 10, that has a CBD-only law. Then with respect to the kind of question of the ones that are advertising that it's CBD only, but it has, you know, some sort of THC type of component to it, there's under federal law, at the federal level, there was a hemp legalization bill. And there's kind of currently some uncertainty in the law as to whether you can take extracts of hemp products that might have mind-altering effects and whether that would still be legal under this federal hemp bill. And it's something that, again, frankly, the law is kind of unsettled. And the places that are selling these kind of products are operating in kind of a legal gray area apart from any of the entities that are doing it, you know, kind of in full compliance with the Wisconsin CBD-only medical law.
Got it. Pam, thank you for the call. And Alex, we are just about out of time today, but I want to thank you for your time and joining us and helping us understand what's going on around the country. Thanks for joining us today.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
Alex Kreit is an assistant professor of law and the director of the Center on Addiction Law and Policy at Northern Kentucky University. He was with us today to talk about Wisconsin's approach to marijuana policy and what's going on in other states and on the federal level.
Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, the state Supreme Court has approved Republican-drawn electoral maps in its latest ruling on redistricting. We'll look at what those new maps mean for elections coming up later this year and who you end up seeing on your ballot and what it means for politics and policy in the years to come. That's tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show. You're listening to Central Time. Here on the Ideas Network, I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Dean Kinetter. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, how often do you give yourself a treat? And do you consider it self-care? Jen White shares your stories and why so many struggle to make time for themselves. That's today at 6 on 1A+.
Now, a Canadian-based mining company called Greenlight Metals received an exploratory license to drill for copper and gold in north-central Wisconsin. A license alone, issued in February of this year, doesn't ensure Greenlight Metals will actually do any mining.
Tentatively, Greenlight Metals plans to drill for copper and gold in Taylor and Marathon counties, including in the Shawamigan Nicolet National Forest. The drilling would occur in the Bend and Reef deposits, where it's said more than 4 million tons of copper and gold are located.
Today, we'll get two perspectives on the economic and environmental impacts of potential mining operations.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think a mining project would bring to Wisconsin? Do you think it'd be good for Wisconsin jobs and employment? Do you have environmental concerns? What questions do you have for our guests? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org.
Scott Manley is Executive Vice President of Government Relations for Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you and good afternoon.
Well, this is in the early stages here. Everything we're talking about is tentative. What are your hopes, Scott, though, for potentially mining in these areas when it comes to the economy and jobs creation?
Well, I think that it would be a tremendous boost to the area for sure if we ended up mining copper and gold and even some silver at the Bend deposit in Taylor County and primarily gold at the Reef deposit in Marathon County. Obviously a huge boost to local jobs. These are typically very, very well-paying jobs, much higher wages than the state average, and oftentimes these are union jobs as well. So I think from a from an economic development standpoint, it would be a real boost for those immediate areas. And then when you start looking at some of the other things that are typically associated with mining operations, like transportation jobs and warehousing jobs and hospitality jobs and so forth, I think it would you would see positive and rippling economic impacts throughout the entire northern part of the state.
In the longer view, Wisconsin had for a long time not quite a ban on this kind of mining, sulfide mining, but close enough to a ban to make it very difficult to open these kind of bans. Can you talk about how the regulatory framework has changed in the state that makes something like this possible?
Well, just as you said, it was called the virtual mining moratorium because it wasn't an outright ban. That's been removed. And you know, basically, if you want to get a mining permit in Wisconsin, it's a very long and rigorous process that you have to go through that will require somebody to demonstrate that they can do mining in an environmentally safe and responsible manner. And that includes posting financial assurance up front before you even dig the first ounce of ore out of the ground, so that if something happened to the mining company and they had to shut down operations, there would be financial resources available to completely restore and reclaim the land where the mining took place. So I think it's important for listeners to understand that this is the very, very, very early stages of what is a very long and rigorous environmental review process that would take years to complete before any mining would be approved.
Talking to Scott Manley from Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce about, as we heard, the potential early stages of mining for copper and gold at two sites in north central Wisconsin. Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Rob is with us in Wausau. Hi, Rob.
Hello. Yeah, you know, we're talking about developing gold mines in Wisconsin, and we're probably going to get this pitch that somehow gold is needed for what, electric vehicles and wind turbines? There isn't anything like that. And no foundry in Wisconsin will use the copper from these mines because they use clean scrap. And I'm wondering why some group like WMC is supporting the short-term profit schemes of a foreign mining company instead of the small businesses and property owners. I mean, how many businesses are worth sacrificing from the outdoor recreation and tourism industry for the sake of letting a mining company dig up our wealth and leave us in economic ruin with contaminated water?
Rob,
Thank you.
thanks for the call. Scott, what do you say?
Well, I think the gentleman is really taking probably a 1920s or 1930s view of mining, and where there was virtually no regulation in place. Look, today we've got mining or modern environmental laws. We've got modern technology for mining techniques. This is not your father's or even your grandfather's or even your great grandfather's mining that's done today. And what you can't do in Wisconsin if you're mining is violate any of our air quality, water quality, groundwater standards. You certainly can't violate at the federal level the Clean Water Act or any of the federal environmental standards too. And I think the gentleman fails to understand that, look, copper is a critical mineral for solar panels, for electric vehicle batteries, for wind turbines, for home wiring, for power transmission. You know, gold, everybody who's got a cell phone is walking around with gold in their pocket. The computers that we have today have gold in them. Every car has gold in them. Small appliances have gold in them. Satellites, all kinds of electric devices. So that, you know, this is a really critical element, a very critical mineral for our economy. And we could just say, hey, let's keep exporting these critical minerals from other countries that don't do environmental regulation as well as we do, and have better and or have worse environmental outcomes, you know, for the planet because we are, you know, relying on third world country mining. We happen to think that's a bad idea.
Thanks for the call, Rob. We'll go to Mark next in Superior. Mark, hi.
Hi, how are you? I kind of agree with what he just said a little bit, because I know that we are promoting electric vehicles so dramatically as the solution to a lot of the problems that we're encountering for the environment. But the very source of those materials comes from the area that we're not willing to have drilling and mining in. And so I think we better either rethink the electrical vehicles or rethink our stance on mining, because as much as we think that we can do both without having the mining, we can't. And we need to have either fall back on the batteries, the electric car, and do something with carbon energy, or we're going to have to agree that we're going to have to get this from the areas that we prize, the northern Wisconsin, northern Minnesota, and northern Michigan. We should not continue to allow countries like Russia and China to supply these materials, because they are not environmentally sensitive and they are ruining the environment in their world. And that's part of our world also. So I think we better be a little conscious of the fact that if we want electric vehicles, we're going to have mining.
Mark, thanks for the call. Scott?
I think Mark stated it very well. And I would just say it doesn't have to be an either or. Either we have economic development and mineral security and the ability to determine our own fate because we're sourcing minerals here instead of relying on dangerous countries, versus do we want to have a clean environment? It absolutely can be both. And in fact, the laws that apply both in this state and at the federal level of government, the mining laws, require as much. There's nobody who's going to get a permit to mine anywhere in Wisconsin that will require us to sacrifice the environment and our public health in exchange for mining. That is just simply not the way modern environmental law and modern environmental practice works.
Thanks for that call. Scott, just in our last few moments, can you talk about the road ahead for a proposal like this?
Well, the mining process, the permitting process, as I said, is very rigorous, and there's a lot of data collection that needs to take place, including mapping out wetlands and streams and doing soil characterization and in fact drilling to find out what type of material you're dealing with in the ground deep below the surface. So there's a lot of I would say data gathering is probably the biggest first step, and then it's analysis of that data that can be used to actually put a permit application together.
Scott, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Scott Manley, Executive Vice President of Government Relations for Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, talking with us today about the economic impact of mining with a couple of proposed sites in north central Wisconsin.
Up next, we'll look at the potential environmental impact of this kind of mining.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your hopes for the future of these plans. Your fears, call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Knetter.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our look at an exploratory mining permit at two sites in north central Wisconsin, looking mainly for copper and gold. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions about the potential for mining. That's 800-642-1234. Dave Bluen joins us now, Mining Committee Chair for the Sierra Club Wisconsin Chapter. Dave, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, again, early stages here, exploratory drilling. What are some of your concerns when it comes to this kind of mining in these kind of places?
Sure. Exploration itself isn't, it certainly isn't full-scale mining, but there are issues with exploration should it go forward, with any proposal in Wisconsin. There are some basic impacts, and drilling holes for exploration intersects groundwater that can introduce contaminants into groundwater and connect otherwise disconnected aquifers that can cause cross contamination. I want to bring up, especially because this has been an important and hot topic for Wisconsinites concerned about their drinking water, but exploration for mining uses drilling fluids that include highly toxic PFAS chemical compounds. So, you know, these are the sorts of things that we don't necessarily want to see introduced into our groundwater and our drinking water. So, you know, as well, there are other impacts to consider: new roads into drill sites and contaminants from the materials that are taken out of the ground that have to be taken care of properly. More importantly, the state DNR really doesn't have a lot of oversight over drilling, and the public has virtually no say over approvals for exploration. DNR does have control over reclamation, that's about the limit of their authority. And one of our problems that we've seen with historical exploration is that boreholes are often left unfilled for many years before companies are required to fill them.
For the mining projects themselves, our last guest, Scott Manley from Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, made the case that mining today isn't what mining used to be. It's safer. We know more about reclamation. There's more safeguards and protections in place. What do you say to that?
Sure. I think in general, that's true. But what makes modern mining different from legacy mining is its scale. It's our ability to move much more material, much lower quality material and process ore that has much smaller percentages of metals in it. And, you know, the main increases improvements in technology in recent years have much less to do with environmental protections and much more to do with improving the technology of the mining itself, meaning that we have reduced labor costs in mining projects by introducing robotics and unmanned vehicles and the like that are simply about improving the bottom line for mining companies and far less about improving environmental quality or environmental protections.
There's also the argument that, you know, we're going to make stuff out of copper. The copper is going to come from somewhere. Even if there is some environmental risk here, is it better to produce in a place with the levels of environmental protection we have in the U.S. versus places around the world with maybe far less protections?
Sure. And I think that's a legitimate argument if we're talking about strategic or you know, strategic minerals that the country needs for defense or other uses. It's not so with copper, and that's because copper is, well, the U.S. is a net exporter of copper. We produce 1.2 million tons of copper a year. It's more than enough for our domestic use. And so should of these two properties that Greenlight Metals is considering, should the Bend deposit with its copper be developed, there's only enough copper there identified so far to cover 5% of U.S. domestic production for a single year. That's a drop in the bucket. To go to one other issue that got brought up a little bit earlier, in terms of copper being a strategic mineral for the use, you know, for electric vehicles, for windmills, for other, other changes that we need to see in infrastructure that help address the climate change crisis. You know, we have more than enough to meet the need in the U.S. Based on U.S. Production alone. And copper is less of a critical mineral for things like for batteries and the like. You know, those are other minerals that aren't being produced, such as, you know, for the properties that Greenlight Metals is considering, things like cobalt and lithium, manganese and nickel, none of which are proposed to be developed by Greenlight Metals.
Talking to Dave Bluen, Mining Committee Chair for the Wisconsin Chapter Sierra Club, looking at mining proposals in north central Wisconsin for copper and gold. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Jordan is with us in Marengo. Jordan, hi.
Hi, how's it going? I have kind of a couple personal connections directly to this issue. My father was major executive for a mining supply company. So he got to travel to, you know, Chile, Mexico, the desert southwest of the U.S., seeing these huge copper installations in arid areas. He was very Republican, very pro-business, very let's go get it done. And before he died, he told me this should not be done in areas with groundwater issues because the damage will be permanent. In a lot of areas with groundwater, there needs to be perpetual wastewater remediation. So, you know, it's good that the guy from WMC talks about laws and stuff, but laws don't stop how rock fractures. Laws don't stop how groundwater moves through fractured rock. So there is no real remediation at all.
Jordan, thanks for the call. Dave, what do you think?
Yeah, Jordan brings up a good point that, you know, especially northern Wisconsin is an incredibly water-rich environment. And mining in metallic sulfides is dangerous because the rock, when it's exposed to air and water, the waste rock especially, and the tailings, when they're exposed to air and water, produce acid mine drainage and the resulting heavy metals that spreads on surface water and groundwater. And what's also important about this is that baked into Wisconsin environmental law is the fact that mining underground and open pit is allowed to pollute groundwater at the site and for many square thousands of acres potentially around a mine site. It's allowed pollution, and it was a nod to the mining company, mining companies, and negotiated by the mining industry with the state of Wisconsin to acknowledge the fact that you can't mine in metallic sulfides or other rock in our state without having to pollute groundwater. It's a simple fact.
Thanks for that call. Peter joins us next in Rhinelander. Peter, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Peter?
I was just curious because I have visited Ladysmith, where the Flambeau mine was located. And when I toured there, they mentioned that there are protections, there's financial backing from the mining company to remediate the pollution that is occurring there. But they also mentioned that it only lasts, the payments only last for about 30 years. And I'd wanted to ask the previous guest if anything had changed or if in reality the burden of all of that goes to the taxpayers after 30 years or if things have changed.
Peter, thanks for that call. Dave, do you know the time period that remediation money is good for?
Yeah, when Flambeau was first closed, the bonding there for the reclamation work was to be held for 30 years. And it's important to note that the bond for reclamation was specific only to reclaiming the site. In other words, the in the very narrow sense of the law for reclamation for mining with Wisconsin, meaning filling up the pit with waste rock, covering it over, regrading it, planting it, and essentially making it look pretty. What the bond doesn't cover is any potential cleanup long term. We no longer have a bonding requirement that would have addressed the need for contingencies like emergency cleanup, that sort of thing. That was repealed along with the Prove It First law for metallic sulfide mining in 2017.
Thanks for that call, Peter. And Dave, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Dave Bluen, Mining Committee Chair for the Sierra Club's Wisconsin chapter. Earlier heard from Scott Manley from Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce looking at the early stages of a couple potential mining sites here in Wisconsin. A company approved to begin exploratory drilling tentatively in north-central parts of the state.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, financial planning can be stressful and maybe discourage us. We'll talk with a Wisconsin finance expert about staying hopeful and positive when working with our money. That's coming up tomorrow here on the Central Time on the Ideas Network.